If we blame something from our past for where we are today, none of that was your fault because that gets you to today. But the moment you realize all of that, from here on out, it's your fault. So do something about it. Nothing you can do about the past. It starts today.
Family life is essential. Jim and I are on a mission to help you live the best one. You'll hear personal stories from thought leaders of strengths and struggles with proven strategies to help you make the most of your 18 summers. I'm your co-host, Jamie Shields.
Hey, 18 Summers Tribe, Jim and Jamie back with a great interview today. I'm really looking forward to.
With our new old friend.
Joel Gandara. I'm going to be honest with you guys because life is not about perfection. We had an incredible conversation with Joel a few weeks ago. And for the first time in over 150 episodes, something happened in the recording. And I think it's selfish because Joel did such a good interview. And we're looking forward to speaking again. And Joel is the author of a newer book, 31 Days to Become a Better Man. But there's so much more to Joel's entrepreneurial journey and family journey that I'm excited to share today.
In all fairness, I've read the book myself. So it's great.
Already. Yes. I've read parts of it. I cheated around to different parts that I'm sure Joel knows which parts those
like
are.
Like sex. Welcome, Joel. So good to see you again.
Good to see you, Joel.
Thank you, guys. Great to see you again.
Yeah. Joel, you know, there are a lot of things that really impressed me about you, but I am a big history buff. I love to hear about people's roots and history. And your story coming from Cuba is something that really touched me in many different ways. And I was hoping you could just share a little bit about your early childhood experience that really helped forge a lot of who you are and it really impressed me.
All right, sure. I heard one time that we don't know it because there are many generations before us, but we are the product of these people who were way before us who we don't even know. And we have a lot of their traits and we have a lot of their life experiences in us because the way they learned to handle life, it carried over. More reason for us to work on ourselves and be the best version we can be. So my dad in 1967 had a choice. See, he was sent to a work camp forced by the communist government of Cuba. He was 17 years old. It's either you go to the military or you go to a forced labor camp. They chose forced labor camp. He wouldn't have wanted to go to their military anyway and help the communist government. So in 1967, shortly after he was sent off, his parents came to that camp and saw him and said, "We have a chance to leave this country. Your mom, your dad, all your siblings, just not you, because you're here trapped in a 3-year sentence." And he had to make that very difficult decision and say, yeah, go ahead, go without me. He met up again with that family 13 years later. Ends up, he had a 12-year-old sister he never met, right? Because she was born right after they left. And so that has an effect on me. I've noticed it shaped my life. I was not in that work concentration camp, but those impacts, but does impact me and my brother and my mom and my dad, obviously, because he's the one that had to suffer through it. But what happened is in 1980, we had an opportunity. If you've ever seen the Scarface movie with Al Pacino, that's the Mariel boat lifts. 125,000 Cubans were let out. United States and its normal humanitarian self accepted a lot of people. Fidel Castro in his normal evilness emptied out the prisons and emptied out the mental asylums. And that's a lot of the people who came in. So a lot of Cuban Americans were responsible for the lowest crime rates, I think, in the United States among Hispanics or thereabouts. Well, after that, they went up a little bit because you brought in a lot of crazy people. People told me here in Miami that they saw crazy people walking in the streets. All of a sudden, you never saw that before. So I came here during that. For me, it was an odyssey. It was a 12-hour boat ride. Leading up to it was a few days of stress for a little kid, for my parents, for everybody. And then coming here was another story, getting here. But the part that's etched in my mind, it's the only tattoo that I have. It's on my brain. And it is that boat ride. 12 hours on this rickety boat. 75 or 74 person capacity. It was about 150 of us squished in there like sardines. Rain was coming in sideways. And for 4 of those hours, there was a bad storm. And my memory as a kid, and I've confirmed this with my parents, when that boat went up and you'd look around, it was absolute sky. And when that boat would drop on that swale, it was 4 walls of water. And this went on for 4 hours. So I can tell you, I have a serious respect, even fear of the ocean. I'll go on a boat, preferably a really large one, but I still have that. I still smell the ocean and it brings me right back to that moment. But I'll tell you what, every bad thing has an end. Every good thing has an end sometimes. The most beautiful moment in my life at that time was cruising into Key West and seeing this large cement dock on the left side, probably made for a battleship. For our little boat, it was very big. And we had all these volunteers giving us soup and chocolate and food. And that was nice after being so long without eating and through all that stress.
Yeah. How old were you again, Joel?
I was 4.5 years old. Fortunately, I have the gift, not by any of my doing, but of a pretty good memory in everyday life, but also of my childhood. So I remember quite a bit. Even if I had a bad memory, that would have made its way through and lasted, that experience.
I remember you mentioned there was one specific person when you arrived on that big dock.
Yeah, there was this Black American soldier dressed in olive green, which if you're Cuban, you're trained to hate olive green because that's what the bad military people are in Cuba. So when I got here, when we pulled in, there was such a serious contrast between the olive green soldier men in Cuba and the olive green uniform soldiers here, because there's this Black American soldier who greeted everyone and smiled and said, welcome to U.S., welcome to America. Wow. And man, you know, those type of things stick with you forever and you feel really appreciative. And what a contrast between those mean, I put it in my book, they were mean, they were yelling, they had dirty looks at us in Cuba, the military. And we got here and the military was nice to us.
It's incredible.
That's so interesting. And how many siblings came over with you? It was your mom. Will you remind me who all came together?
Yeah. It was my dad, my mom, and my older brother, Neil, who's 5.5 years older than me, and myself. Just us. That's all there is.
Yeah. And now does everyone have like different counts of it, like of how it went down? Or is it something that you ever talk about? Or is it something that you just share knowing you experienced together?
Yeah, we talk about it. It's come up whenever we meet someone new and the conversation gets to that, we'll talk about it. So I've heard it from my parents' angle, my brother, myself, and it all goes in line. But I'll tell you what, 3 years ago on the 40th anniversary of this event, I had Telemundo, the TV station here, with a multi-Emmy award-winning newscaster and the producer and cameraman, a sound guy, all this stuff in my living room. And so they were featuring a different person from the Mariel boat lifts every night on the news. Wow. And then repeating it in the morning the next day. And so after they contacted me to interview me and choose me for one of the nights, I told them my parents and about my parents' story. And they said, we'd like to talk to your parents. So we did a 2-for-1. They recorded my parents' session. And then an hour later, they recorded mine. And that filled 2 of their nights. Well, I got to hear something for the first time that blew me away. I was sitting behind the camera. I was with my wife. And my mom and dad were being interviewed on my couch. And my mom started to say that she, first of all, they were taking kids from Cuba to send them to Angola to fight in a civil war in Africa, to fight on the communist side. And a bunch of Cuban kids were dying. And my mom said, you know, my kids are next. And that's the reason I pulled the trigger to take them on such a dangerous journey. So I'd never heard it like that. So that was one of 2 amazing things that she said. And the second one was, she was crying and praying to God to forgive her for bringing her 2 little boys into the ocean to die because she was convinced we were dying. We were all going to drown. There wasn't enough life jackets. There was a storm that, forget about it. A bunch of boats went down and the people were never found during that whole boat lift. So that hurt me so bad. I had to leave the room. Mm-hmm. I had to go somewhere else. I was crying. I can probably count on 1 or 2 hands the times I've cried in my life. And that was one of them. That was tough to hear my mom. Imagine as a parent saying, okay, we're going to die. This is about to happen. We're dying any minute now. And I've got my 2 little boys right here. I'm holding one on each side and we're all going down and dying. So God, please forgive me for doing this to them.
Wow. I mean, that is so powerful. What inspires me, Joel, is starting to read your book and our personal conversations. You're the type of person I feel like that you almost put this pressure on yourself. I need to earn this. And I think you have. Like, I want to give you that compliment, you know, where you didn't look at the thorns, you looked at the rose petals. I mean, starting from young entrepreneurship, the example you're setting for your own children, which we'll get into, the men that you're now mentoring, the businesses you built. It's like, it's so cool to hear someone like you said, I'm going to make the most of this. And it's really cool to see that unfold.
Yeah. And I'll go into more detail. I did keep my eyes maybe on that rose, but I'll tell you what, I got hit with a lot of thorns. A lot of bad stuff did happen along the way, starting with, I'm not complaining. I got to this country. That's the most important thing in my life. But we did grow up in poverty. So those first many years, we're in a bad neighborhood, we're in bad situations, we're feeling always inferior to everyone around me. And even in a ghetto, when you're real poor, like really poor, and your parents don't take government assistance and they just worked and made the minimum, they were making like $5 an hour in the early 80s, but working 60 hours a week, it's not enough. And not buying cable TV and not buying anything fancy, You have the roof over your head for a little place you rent. We rented a basement the first little bit. And then we had just the minimum, least expensive clothing and a lot of hand-me-downs from friends and church and that sort of thing. So there were some times there where it didn't feel so great in the beginning.
Sure. Yeah. That's when you first started your businesses.
Yeah. 10 years old, fourth grade, I had my first business. And I'll tell you, it was an absolute success. It's all relative, right? When you're poor and your parents can't give you snack money and they can't buy you toys, if you could buy yourself a donut after school or you could buy yourself your own robot, that is amazing. So I went and got these garbage pail kid cards, collector trading sticker cards. I never peeled one. I never kept one for myself. These were all for selling. But I took them to school on Monday morning after I bought them and I showed all the kids and they went crazy. And I remember quickly calculating what a pack costs, dividing it by how many cards, and figuring out my cost. Let's call it, maybe it was 5 cents a card. I don't remember today, but let's say 5 cents a card. And I started selling them for 25 cents a card. Some sold for 50, and the really beautiful cards sold for a dollar. And then guess what? I was able to buy myself a donut after school here and there, but I was able to save about $50 and buy myself a transformer, the most expensive, beautiful base. It was the biggest transformer they sold. It was called Omega Supreme. And I played the heck out of that thing and I felt so proud to own it. And yeah, that was for me the hugest victory ever in business.
Love that.
It's amazing. And now how do you come from something so underprivileged, or as you said, you were in poverty, you had this like major event, and no doubt things like that get you closer to your tribe. Like I imagine you and your brother were super tight. I imagine you took great care of your parents always. There are certain things that I think a shared trauma experience or shared struggles really create in a family. Do you feel as though, was it in some ways bonding, or like, what do you take?
It's interesting. I could see it totally going that way. I'm sure maybe the majority of the times it would be that way. I'll tell you what though, my brother and I were never close ever. He's 5.5 years older than me. I think he had a lot of traumas from coming here. I think he started taking those out on me when we got here. He had it rough. I think he had it harder than I did. And I'll give you one example. Got here, went into fourth grade. We got here and 3 months later, we were in school. Needless to say, I failed. I did not pick up the language and I went through an entire school year and I didn't understand one word. I honestly hated the kids and I hated the teachers because none of them knew how to speak Spanish. That's how I saw it. Like they're all idiots. They can't communicate. No one understands me. I'm alone in the playground. It sucked. But my brother had it rough. And I'll tell you one example. They sent a letter home, apparently, that said, tomorrow, make sure you pack a lunch. We had school lunch. Pack a lunch because your son is going to the beach all day. And my parents must have mixed that paper up with everything else, couldn't read it. And my brother went and spent a 6, 7, 8 hour day with zero food and zero communication. And no one offered him anything. And he just sat there all day on the beach, just waiting for, I don't know what we're doing here. I don't know when we go home. He was 10 years old. So I think he had a bunch of things like that. And so we all went our own ways and those stresses that put us through, and we all have our own outcomes from it.
Yeah. So Joel, you've taken it in an approach, and I know this from our conversations, where you talk about these things because we've asked you to share with our community, but you are not a dweller. You don't dwell on things. And there's some way that you've been able to create this to be positive fuel where other people could use it as like a trump card, fall backwards, do nothing, go into drugs and whatever it is. And you've done the opposite. How have you been able to not become a dweller and really use this as a springboard? Because that's what I see.
How are you teaching others to do that?
Because that's such an important thing, this resilience and perseverance and optimism. I think it's lacking today, but you've been able to take it by hold. How have you done that? Like, what advice would you give to people to not be a dweller?
Yeah. So we all have traumas from our past, whatever they are. If you were brought up silver spoon and you had everything, well, maybe you didn't get that Ferrari on your 18th birthday. Maybe that's a trauma, because I do hear all kinds of traumas. Most of the time I'm thinking, that's not that bad. It could be a lot worse. Right? So,
I'm not judging you, but that's not that bad.
Yeah, that's not that bad. But here's the thing. If we blame something from our past for where we are today, right? Our parents had a limiting belief about money, and that led me to this way of thinking, and I wasted my money, and I never saved, I never invested. None of that was your fault, because that gets you to today. But the moment you realize all of that, from here on out, it's your fault. So do something about it. Nothing you could do about the past, everything you could do about the future, because especially today, get on YouTube and learn about, in this case, money, learn how to invest. You were a bad parent because your parent was a bad parent and a drunk. Perfect. None of that was your fault till today. It starts today. You were mean to your kids yesterday, but today you've come to this realization. It's all on you going forward. So that's something I share a lot when I coach one-on-one or in groups and all that. And that seems to trigger something. And this isn't because I read it in a book. I have no qualifications as a mentor or coach or anything, but this is what I do for a living full time now. Okay. So I believe in no excuses. I also picked the best partner in the world, my wife of 21 years. We've got four kids. You know what's on our refrigerator? Because my son brought it back from the mail from the Army boot camp when he was there. He's 18 years old, turned 18 in boot camp. Did that between his junior and senior year in high school just recently. So he's in high school. He's a senior. He's an American soldier. He's a sharpshooter. He's a mechanic already reporting every one weekend a month. He also works in a pharmacy. He does a lot of stuff. That's our oldest. But my wife got a sense in a letter, and I read every letter, and they were written to me too, from him at boot camp. And it said, this is the hardest thing I've ever been through. This isn't what I thought it would be. All the negative talk of 10 weeks of making you suffer. But that week was rough. They made them sleep outside. They kicked them out of the dorm or, you know, the barracks. It was rough for them. And that was before the forge, where they went out for days, eating MREs and being out there suffering. So my wife sent to Walgreens to make a postcard, and it's a David Goggins face. And it says, no one cares, work harder.
Wow.
That's their mom. That's my wife. So having a partner like that is just, we're both tough and we both push. We work out 1 to 3 times a day, each of us. We both train jujitsu. We both lift weights. We run yoga. We do all these things. And our kids, I think we're passing that along to them, but it helps to have that no excuses attitude. It also helps to surround yourself with people like that. I trained yesterday jujitsu at a friend's academy instead of where I regularly train. And when I started to roll with this monster black belt, I said to him, he's the owner of the academy, he's my friend. I said, I trained this morning. I'm really tired. And he called me out on it. And he says, don't say that. Don't say that negative talk to yourself. You're reminding yourself you're tired. Just push. And after, he's a great instructor and he put everybody together. He does this every time and he gives life lessons. And he said, I'm not going to say who, but one person here told me he was really tired this morning. And I don't care. Don't say that. You're sending these negative messages to yourself. So I thought that was fantastic. Now, to wrap up the answer, my long answer to your good question, I have something that motivates me. Every single morning, I'm pretty organized. Everything's in a row. Things are organized. I can find my stuff fast. I have a place for my wallet, my keys, everything's in one place, right? I'm very organized. It's the only way to do it when you have ADHD and you're going to lose everything. You waste your time. So you have to get organized over the years. But I have one thing out of place. When I walk into my closet every morning, all of my shirts are lined up perfectly. But there's one shirt at the beginning, right when I walk in, and it's facing me. And it's the shirt that I wore on the boat when I came from Cuba. It's the only thing I have from Cuba. And it's my reminder of, number one, what I went through. Because when you go through something difficult, you shouldn't let it be in vain. That's your motivator. You went through something difficult, keep that keepsake and use it to get you to the next thing. It also, for me, is my number one source of happiness. Because when I'm grateful, I am on top of the world. So every morning I'm grateful because I walk in, I go, I live in this country. This is amazing. I have 10 to 15 first cousins that I don't even know. And they're over there and they don't have this opportunity. So I got to make it count. That for me is a huge reminder of why I'm here and what I have to accomplish.
So important.
And now, Joel, it sounds as though you and your wife definitely run a tight ship with your children. And I know from our last conversation, there's some great lessons that we took away. I would love to talk some more about your parenting and the way in which you guide your children collectively with your wife. How was her upbringing? I know she's not here, so I don't respectfully, you have such a big story. How does she come alongside with such similar views and support? That's not always common.
Yeah. So she's the son of immigrants. Her parents came from Cuba when they were kids and grew up here. So she's the equivalent of my kids, right? Parents came young. She was born in New Jersey, brought up here in South Florida. And she, in high school at 16 years old, was diagnosed with cancer, found by a fluke, and had surgery and avoided chemo and radiation. But later in life, after we'd already had two kids, before we had our third, they did one more test to see if everything was gone, to make double sure before she goes through another pregnancy. And they found a little bit more cancer cells. So she had to go through a couple rounds of radiation. And if you ask her if she's a victim, she says, what? I'm here. I'm healthy. She is the toughest person I know. She was a registered nurse for 10 years, retired at 30. As my business picked up, she was able to just focus on the family. And that's when we had the third kid and the fourth kid. It would have been nice to have a big family, but we said, you know, we're working. We're both busy. We can't do that. And that opened that opportunity up. My wife is very tough. Maybe one day you'll interview her, because in a month she launches her series of challenge book, which is just for women. It's called It's My Turn. And I think that title says a little bit. It's that I've been working on myself all my life, trying to get ahead and this and that. And at one point I learned that I got to bring her along. And she has been bringing herself along for years in self-development, learning language, physically fit, all these good things that she does, leading others and helping. And so now it's her turn to kind of lead a tribe and make it official. So yeah, she's absolutely amazing.
That's great.
I really love that. It's my turn. Like sticking a pin in that. I'm working on a project for next year, but I definitely would love to
talk
with her. That's great.
I think there's something important here, and I don't want to stress on it, especially if someone listening feels, but I got to tell you, Joel, Jamie and I have said, we're so lucky that we have, you know, you've heard of value-based decision-making. Jamie and I align on our values really well. We're not twins on everything, but our values really align. And what I find for younger people, their job is to test the fences. You've heard of test the fences. Will I get a shock? Will I get a shock? And when there's not a united front, that's when almost the unhealthy pack leadership falls apart. Mm. And kids can start to get too much power within a thing, or encouragement of bad habits or opening of things.
Or like division.
Between,
like, I'll go ask the nice one.
Let me ask this. And I've seen that with some divorced families we've worked with, where there is this. And there is, and I guess I say this to the people out there, because it makes me pause and reflect, gosh, I'm so lucky that Jamie and I align like you and your wife, Joel. It is just such a blessing, because we can really navigate some difficult waters together and experience the good times even better. But like you just said, I want to reiterate that that is so important, that there is an alignment if the family is going to be optimized in relationship and enjoyment and impact and service. I think that just can't be understated.
Yeah. And the word lucky kind of gets under my skin, because I've been told so many times that I was lucky to have met my wife. I say, yes, I was lucky to have met her, because that was by chance, but I wasn't lucky to have married her. I treated marriage and the interview process just like I would a business partner, a business, an investment. It was serious. Every date, every phone call, everything was me filtering through. Is this checking the boxes? Right. I coach some guys that are younger. I've been hired by some very successful men over the last few years to coach their sons. And we focus on that big time. It's not just the feeling. Yes, you got to feel love. You've got to feel physical attractiveness, but you got to make sure you're in alignment politically, on money, on bringing up kids. Fortunately, my wife and I went through a process through the Baptist church where we got married, where we had to go through this grinder where 40% of the people who go through it don't get married. And these are people in love with a date, and they put a deposit, and 40% don't get married. I remember hearing that and getting a little nervous and then going, oh no, this is good. And we made it through with flying colors. So it's not just luck, just like you're not lucky if you're wealthy. If you were born rich, yes. But if you started with average or not too much and you built a business, you put 20 years, 30 years of hard work. You didn't blow it on crack cocaine. You didn't go blow it on crazy things. You invest and you build up, in your guys' case, real estate. So we're not that lucky. Now, United Front, you just said the word a week ago. I presented to a group in entrepreneurs organization, and it was on how to develop independent children. I didn't have the word strong there, but I focused on strength a lot when I spoke. I had 10 slides. Number one was United Front. This can't be done successfully without both parents on board. Now, you're a young guy trying to pick a spouse for the future. That's a big one.
Cute.
Now, you're not a young guy and you've been married for 20 years. You got to figure, and there's some work to do there to become a united front.
Yeah. I got to tell you, Joel, when so many years ago, I can't even remember. I was invited to go on a day date to meet someone. And I went on it and I left kind of flat. And it was my famous word, oh, how did you like it? Eh. Like it just, I was looking for something else. And I went home that day and sat at my home desk and I pulled out a sheet of paper and I just had this intuitive moment called faith or whatever, or, you know, divine clarity. And I wrote out this description of what I saw myself being with, what I really desired, all the things you just listed there. And 9 years later, I gave Jamie that list and proposed to her on the beach. And when she reads it, I'm getting on a knee. I said, I wrote you this 9 years ago. She's like, we've only been dating a little over a year. I said, yeah, but I wrote this to you 9 years ago. And when she opened it, I mean, this one sheet of paper, when we actually had read at our wedding, was her to a T. So yeah, I think when I say luck, it's creating your own luck. But man, clarity is just so important there, where I think the young people, they don't have the courage to ask, what do you really want? Or stop and think, what do you desire? And all those traits that you just said, well, no, I can't really try to align with all those things. I think that's nuts not to try to set that standard, which you obviously did, and I did.
We've walked our boys through this activity and a lot of their friends. And it actually has been a strainer that a couple of them have ended relationships on. And then other ones have kind of seen a bit of a navigation. I know one of our sons did it and he was like, ooh, I need to think about that, you know, and so interesting to see them. And several of them spent a period of time then. So, you know, they're early 20s now. They were maybe 18 at the time, a few of them I'm thinking of. And maybe they spent a hard year being like, gosh, it sucks being alone. And then clarity came and they're now with somebody who's maybe better aligned, even though they're still very young for long-term committed relationships. But that is where their mind is. And I truly think that it's important to teach our children from a young age, like that is the purpose of dating. It's always to find your alignment for a greater purpose, like a family or creation in the world, you know?
100%. So two things. Number one, they teach the Pythagorean theorem in high school. I guess I calculated it and I knew how to do it at one point. I've never touched it again since that day in 10th grade. But why don't they teach these things? Imagine, I know the house, the family's better for teaching these things, but man, if they would spend a month saying, do this exercise, plant it in your mind, subconsciously now, people are going to develop that and work at it. And my son, our oldest, had a girlfriend, just turned 18. He had his first girlfriend a while back. And I noticed some things that didn't go in line with what I know what he wants. But at that age, he doesn't know what he wants. So it took me to point it out and say, hey, Ryan, you remember when we were there at that park and she finished her game and she was carrying all her heavy bags and you kept offering and she told you, no, I could do it myself. I go, is that what you want? Do you want a girl who doesn't want your help, who makes you feel he was carrying nothing and she had like three bags that were really heavy? She just wanted to show him how tough she is. That's fine for her and for her future mate, whoever that is. My son realized when I brought it up to him, he goes, I don't want that. I want to be able to help my girlfriend and I want to carry her stuff and be the hero. I go, then perfect. Well, guess what? After a bunch of those conversations, and I mean a bunch of them, even from Ryan, I noticed the way you guys were holding hands. I don't want to, you know, say too much, but I was walking behind you and I'm your dad. And she was dominating your hand and you were like the little kid underneath. Do you want that? And he's like, no, I don't want that. I don't like that. I didn't even realize that. All these things that I pointed out, guess what? His next girlfriend, the new one, the great one that he's a crazy mad love with, is fitting all those things that he visualized about what he wants. So I love the exercise that you guys have done.
Oh, good.
And it's so interesting that sometimes like subtleties, things that you're like, oh, I didn't realize how important that was. But that ends up becoming the big things 15 on down the road. And you're like, oh, gosh. And she would even regret it. His ex-girlfriend, she'd be 10 years down the line, like, God, how come he never carries these bags for me? Well, because you had so damn much to prove. And that's a good reminder for me because I tend to be that person too. Like, I got it. I can take it all. But it's a good reminder to like soften. What do I really want? And what do I really want in my partner as we continue to create life in front of us, you know?
Yeah.
That's, you know, how you learn a lot about how to avoid problems by talking to so many people who are in those problems, and you ask them, hey, can you look back 15 years and tell me what red flags you should have noticed? And then they go, yeah, that time when I offered to carry her bag, it was really adamant that I can't help her, that you start finding them. Obviously, it's hard to go backwards. You can't go backwards. But yeah, that's a good way to learn what works and what doesn't.
Well, and I've seen some obvious ones, Joel. Like, this has happened a few times with people we've worked with. I mean, and I do this for cautionary tale for everyone listening. Literally, there was a few people that said, well, about having the family, there was this big gist on having a family. Well, she said she never wanted to have kids, but I thought that that would change. Mm. Or he said he had no interest in having children, but I figured I would learn to be okay with that. So they weren't being true to themselves. Like, one person said, I want to have children. The other person was like, nah, no interest. Nope, I don't want to do that. And something that monumental, which I think is a very large decision.
It's a big value.
And they would ignore it. So I always tell people, don't ignore the obvious, or don't try to change the answer that's given. If you take inventory and X comes back, don't say, okay, no, I could probably turn that into Y. And we all try to do that in different things, whether we're looking at our numbers in our business, or you get a very clear answer and you're like, I think that could change, or no, that's not the truth. And I just tell people, if you take inventory, listen to the results you get back.
Yeah. And you know, that complacency of just accepting something that's not quite right for you, I think might come from a low self-esteem. So what do? You address it at the root. How do you develop better self-esteem? Exercise, eat well, self-development, work on issues that you have. And then you show up as this new, better person. And guess what you're going to attract, right? Yeah. I use this situation in my kids. We know someone who, she was in really bad shape physically, bad habits, all these bad things. Well, she got married. As you can imagine, the guy's not a winner, because her pool of candidates was down here and it was tiny. So I always explain that to my kids. I say, how do you think I got a quality woman like your mom? How did I get a wife like that? Because I took care of myself. I ate right. I exercised. I read a lot of books and I put things to action. I didn't sit around and play video games. I don't drink. I don't watch a lot of TV at all. I don't watch TV. All these things made me now get a bigger pool. I said, because I wasn't born Brad Pitt. So I have to work really hard at myself to get that quality person. And that's who I got from the hard work.
Well, I love that.
We always just say that I'm into charity.
I like a good sense of humor, so that works. Hey, you know, Joel, I want to talk about, you've built successful businesses, sold successful businesses, all starting from the Garbage Pail Kids, the underwear, multiple underwear businesses, now successful coaching. But what I liked about our personal conversations, then our lost episode, was when you were talking about this bike ride that you took.
Yeah,
I think stories are just such powerful parables.
Being intentional parents.
Well, that's what I had and being out. Around.
The
being
question present. Is one and the same. I was going to be like, back off. I have a question.
Well, I love this story about bike riding with your kids. Mm-hmm. Will you retell that story and kind of the moral behind it? Because Jamie and I talked about that.
You recently sold your company, right?
Yep.
And then, yeah. So bring us up to, that's the exact story I was going to ask.
Yeah, we both were hit by it. It was so good.
So I sold my company this year, at the time we're recording this, in 2023. But this story goes back 9 years, the bike ride. So the bike ride story happened like this. We had just moved into this neighborhood, gated community on 2 18-hole golf courses. The shortstop for the Miami Marlins lives a few blocks down. Their former left fielder lives down that way, all within this gated community. Beautiful homes, very nice. Safest city in Florida is always in the top three every year. So I had already ran every street and bike road through it all. And it was summertime. We had just moved here in March. And I take my kids on a long bike ride. My two oldest at the time, they were elementary school age. And I say, I'm going to blow them away, because two blocks down, they are absolute mansions on the golf course, just ridiculously beautiful homes. And I'm waiting for their reaction as we turn the corner and get in there. And as we're riding in there, they go, whoa, but they couldn't believe the houses. And then they see the next one and it's even more beautiful and more and more. We get to the end and they've now seen, I don't know, 30 amazing homes. And they, one of them says, why didn't we buy a house on this street? And why did we buy where we live? And it's funny perspective, right? Because I can't believe that I have the house that I have, coming from where I came from. And to them, that's normal. So I said, you know what? It's the middle of summer, middle of the day, and I'm out here riding bike with you guys, right? They go, yeah, that's cool. And we're slowly riding through that big cul-de-sac a few times. And I said, I could have bought one of these houses. You see that house right there for X amount of millions? I could have bought it, but I would have a mortgage. I wouldn't have been able to buy it cash. I would have to finance that. And it's not just about the payments. I could make the payments. However, those houses are so expensive that I might be stressed out. I'd be up here because it's not just the money I have to pay the bank. It's the taxes I have to pay. Those are $40,000 a year taxes on those homes. It's the electrical bill. It's the cleaning bill. It's all the expenses, the insurance, everything would be so expensive that guess what? I wouldn't be here riding bike with you guys right now. And by the way, we've been riding for miles. Have you guys seen another dad out here today? And they both said, no, we haven't seen another dad. And I go, so would you prefer to have this house? And both of them said, no, we like our house better. And that day gave me tremendous clarity, because even I, who was happy about the home we had just bought a few months before, would occasionally have that itch and go, I could have bought a bigger house. I could have bought it on that golf course with that view. And I could have gotten it with a bigger pool and an outdoor kitchen. I could have. And then that day gave me this relaxation that changed my life. My kids have no idea that that moment changed my life, but it let it all go. Because up to then, I was chasing money so that I could get the better thing. And not like a new fancy sports car, something more responsible, like a nicer house, things like that. But when is it enough? Yeah. I don't want to be 90 years old and getting old and sick and now saying, I regret, like the majority of them, I regret not spending time with my kids. I regret not being with my friends. I regret chasing money. And that day in my late 30s, it changed everything for me.
That's a moment of clarity right there.
Yeah. And how neat, like, God forbid if it comes before 90 and it's 60 or it's, you know what I mean? And then that regret just multiplies. And I think so often we have conversations about when is enough. We have this conversation with our older boys too, and we've never really been able to come up with a dollar. All we can talk about is the feeling
and the how.
It's not the how much, it's the how. Like, what does it feel like? Are we able to do date nights? Are we able to spend, our goal is a third of our time in Costa Rica, a third in Florida, and a third in
adventure spots,
wherever we choose as a family. Like you said, that feeling of, is our stress level down closer to our feet than our forehead? Am I able to be present and look people in their eyes? Am I able to take a bath? And, you know, just all of these things. It's the how, not the how much. And I hear that's exactly what you're saying, is to be able to ride that bike and be present is just so much more valuable. And I know too, and we're running short on time. It's funny. Now that we know you better, we have even more to talk about.
We'll have to have him back on with your wife.
That would be amazing. So, another thing, while we're in the vein of money, I know you, like ourselves, have clearly communicated to your children, your mom and I have money, you do not have money. So we're wealthy, you are not wealthy. Now, I would love for you to share a couple of those tools in your intentional parenting that you do in guiding your children in taking personal responsibility for everything from happiness to fitness into wealth, so that they can create a life in which they're able to be present for and feel productive and successful, as you've been able to create.
Yeah. So our kids have seen from day one that they were born, our stories and where we're at and comparisons. I'm not in this cloud and hiding anything from them. There's no bubble. I'm showing them. You see that car? When I was a kid, that would have been my dream car. And they go, that? Right? You see that house? That would have been my dream house. You see what that teacher's salary? That would have been my parents' dream to make what a teacher makes, right? So they have this. They may not have their foot in that because they never lived it, but they can see what that side would be like. They've also done charitable work and they've gone to neighborhoods and they've seen things. They've donated things to places where we have to go and see all those things. So we tell our children a lie. See, my kids are probably not going to watch this because they hear enough about me and they don't want to watch all the podcasts I've been on. So we tell them there's no inheritance for them, that we're leaving everything to charity. And that's a lie. We do lie about that. We're leaving it to them, all four of them. But what would it help them? It's like someone on government assistance and that safety hammock that is provided of, hey, don't ever worry. We're always going to take care of you. What happiness does that person have? You have happiness when you create and build and lead. So we want our kids to do that. And they've been doing that since they were little. There's a fire under them because we told them there's no college. You want to go to college? Like your mom and I did, we paid for it ourselves. You want a car? Buy it. You want car insurance? Buy it. You want clothes after you're 16? Buy it. Now, we don't just dump them into the world that harsh. We've taught them how to make money. My son Ryan, by 18, had $30,000 saved up in the bank. How did he do that? He figured out with my coaching and my guidance that I provided him as a father that you can do this. You can have things. You can make your own money. So guiding him, but letting it be his ideas, he called a wholesale company that sells pallets of chocolate at a time. And we get pallets delivered to our house of chocolate. And we have since he was a little kid. He wholesales it to his younger siblings. He wholesales it to his friends. And he goes to shopping centers. When we go to a restaurant, one of our kids will rotate and have the box on the table. The waiters usually clean them out. It's phenomenal. The markups are amazing. My son at 18 has now started coaching kids. They pay him a tiny little fee a month. He wholesales them boxes. He shows them how to set up their Square payments so they can take credit cards, Zelle, link it to a bank account, all of this. So that's what we've been doing. And, you know, it's paying off. At 16, our two oldest boys, one hit 18 now and the other one's 16. They're on their own financially. They're paying their own things. They want to go to school. They're paying for their school. They're paying for this. They're doing all of that. So my 18-year-old last month bought his first car, called me as I was leaving jujitsu on a Sunday. I just showered up and he said, can you come to the dealership? Where are you at? He said, I'm at a dealer. And I just test drove a bunch of cars. There's this car that I'm interested in. What do you think? If you could just come down and give me the final approval. I went down. We test drove it together. I go, yeah, Ryan, it's a good car, good price. You ready? He said, yeah, I'll pay for it. He paid for it cash. He bought it used a few years, so it's already depreciated a lot of value. And then I said, now you know you have to set up your insurance. And he said, yeah, I already called USAA, the military insurance. I already set it up. I already paid.
Nice, yeah.
Everything's done. To me, all I want is that mental peace that my kids are going to be fine, that I've helped them become as independent. I think that's the best gift we could give our kids. Imagine if they depend on me and then I'm not there anymore. What's going to happen? Now I have this stress of what their life's going to be like. Their lives are going to be great. They're going to be as good as mine or better.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Self-reliance, especially in the financial realm, there is that first generation wealth trap. And from what I've seen of the trap, it's your heart gets bigger than your financial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've had to hold back. And like you said, it would have been easy for you to write the check for that car. Boom. But that which we obtain too easily, we don't appreciate. His muscles just got weaker in something that's really important for him able to do the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. So I love that. And that's something we're definitely trying to aspire to do. Or for our son's first home, he's 20. He's saving. He has about the down payment to be able to do it. We may co-sign on it, but he has to put up all the money. He has to do all the stuff. And we have to approve of the deal. And I understand, Jamie and I understand real estate pretty well. Where say, hey, if something doesn't happen, then we're on it. Then we have to take over this asset. So I have to approve of it. But it's been so tempting, Joel, over the last few years to hand him an investment property. Jamie and I, and we had friends doing that. We just thought it doesn't feel right. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah. So I'll take it one step further. You said you see the problem happen after first generational wealth when the heart gets bigger than the financial intelligence. It's maybe the heart, but it's also when our vision gets shorter. We think we're doing something for somebody in the moment, and that's going to be great for them. I have a long-term vision for things. Yeah. I want to see them succeed long-term. And I know that if I give them this thing today, it's going to help them today. But what's the long-term impact? I want them to feel it. You know, when I was young, I was 17 years old, my dad gave me his old car. It was a Hyundai Excel, but it was the first year that they released Hyundais in 1986. So it was an old car. And the first year Hyundai, now Hyundai is one of the most reliable cars in the world. Back then, they were one of the worst cars in the world. And so it lasted me a few months, right? But you know why? It could have lasted me 2 years, 3 years, and then it would have broken it down anyway. But he gave it to me. And sure, it was probably worth $600. I mean, it was worth nothing. But I did not take care of it. I did not change the oil as often as I should have. I did not drive it the way I should have. But guess what happened? My next car cost me $1,000. It lasted me 3 years. I was under that car every 3 months changing the oil. I flushed the transmission, things that there was no YouTube. I figured all this stuff out. And I did all of that because it was mine. And guess which car I had the most pride in? And guess which success breeds success? Which success I can look back at and say, yeah, right there, I did well. So then I did the next thing. And then at 22, I bought my first house. And I did these things. But had I gotten it too easy in the beginning, I wouldn't have done any of that.
I mean, no building blocks, right? Those were building blocks right there. It was
muscles. You're growing those muscles. Yeah. That's so important. Right. Gosh, we love our time with you. Thank you for it again.
Yeah. Where can people learn more about 31 Days to Become a Better Man, your coaching? We want to definitely make sure that our tribe knows about you.
Sure. It's a simple program. It's a book for $20. It's a program for $199, 31 days. I'm in it 100%, providing mentoring, guiding, coaching in that group setting. And it's a book where you do one chapter a day. You read for 3 to 5 minutes a day. That's it. Then you go do this action.
Yeah.
I guarantee everyone that joins it that I will give them their $199 back if it doesn't change something in their life. If they make an effort and it doesn't change your life, then I failed. So far, started it this year, 250 guys have been through it. All have told me it's changed their life. So something's there. It's my name. My website is my name, joelgandara.com. It's all there. I don't need the money and I'm not pressuring anybody into it. But if they see that they want to level up in some part of their life, I'd be happy to help them on that journey.
Awesome. Well, Joel, we're a big fan of yours. We love our time together. I'm glad we were introduced through mutual friends. We'll definitely have you and your wife back on. We love continuations and so does our community. So thanks again for your time today. I'm glad we had this mysterious disappearance because now some of the more stories that came out, I think were even better. So I really appreciate your openness, your sharing, and we'll look forward to having you back with 18 Summers.
Thank you, Jimmy Jamie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joel. Thanks for joining the 18 Summers podcast and putting your family in priority position. Subscribe and leave a review and help other families just like you.